We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Deisha Dyer is a speaker and creative event strategy consultant who was most notably known as the former Obama administration social secretary, and this Philadelphia native and former hip-hop journalist became a White House intern at the age of 30 while attending community college. She led a team that coordinated the 2015 visit of Pope Francis, as well as coordinating state dinners with heads of states from China, Canada, and Italy, and booked legendary performances by some names you may or may not recognize. Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen, and the cast of the Broadway musical Hamilton. And today, this Milton Hershey grad comes on The Spark to discuss her new book, Undiplomatic, where Deisha shares her roadmap from imposter to impact. And I'm happy to have her on The Spark with us today. Deisha, hello. Good afternoon.
Hello. 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 Good afternoon. It's so good to be here with you.
Yes, likewise. So I'm just going to jump right into things here. Milton Hershey, can you tell us about your time there, you know, as a local regional person that's doing so many dope things? You know, can you tell us about your origin story being at Milton Hershey?
Definitely. So Milton Hershey School, as most people know, is in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And I went there when I was in fifth grade. My brother and I, who were a couple years older than us, my parents are divorced, and my mom knew it better to put me somewhere that I could get a good, stable education, have a good, stable home life. So I went to Milton Hershey, and I was there from my fifth grade years until I graduated. So I was a senior. And I would say that, you know, I was a wayward child, very much so, I think, at Milton Hershey, really, you know, finding my footing, you know, without my family there, but definitely took advantage of volunteer opportunities and other things that were afforded to us at Milton Hershey, where I, you know, really got the grounding of community there. But I learned a lot about myself there and learned about others. And so, yes, that's kind of my origin story of how I got to Milton Hershey.
So your time post Milton Hershey, but prior to the Obama administration, what were you doing?
I was doing a lot. I went to college and then dropped out of college. And then I was a hip hop journalist for a number of years. And then I worked at the mall. I did a lot of things. A lot of things I did also were in the community. So I was an HIV AIDS advocate since I was 14 years old, actually at Milton Hershey. And so I continued that, a lot of my activism around women, around feminine rights, around Black rights, did a bunch of that between, after graduation until I applied to go to Community College of Philadelphia at 29 years old, which then led me to apply for a White House internship in my 30s. And so then that's when my White House career started, when I was 31.
Shout out to CCP. Shout out to CCP. Yes. Yeah, definitely. Now you applied to this internship at the White House, and you are a community college student. You know, this is something that is out of the realm of normalcy here. So this is one of those moments that I like to point out when I say, oh, you're trusting your dopeness here. So can you take us to that moment, you know, as this community college student, 29 years old, you know, again, against the grain, against tradition, what was it that made you want to apply for this internship?
Definitely. You know, for me, somebody who had not been involved in politics too much, but still was really a community activist, I didn't really ever see myself in politics. I didn't understand it. I think, like many of us, I just saw it from a distance and was like, oh, that doesn't affect me. So I was kind of, too young and not, civically engaged or educated enough to understand. But then when President Obama, then Senator Obama, started running for president and he started giving speeches, and people in the community started talking about this man that was kind of on the scene, talking about things in the community, from poverty to trans rights to, to education. I really gravitated towards that, and I think that that really hooked me in the sense of saying, this is amazing. Can I be part of this whole, hope and change campaign that this man is, questing to bring to America? And I didn't think I was qualified. I didn't think that I would ever get an internship. I didn't understand even what an internship was. I thought I was too old. And when I got the community college, I got to community college and learned a little bit more about internships, and then, got the White House internship across my desk one day for somebody to say, Deisha, can you pass this on to the mentees in your community who you mentor that are in college? I decided to look into it a little bit further and apply. I fit all the qualifications. I was in school. There was no age restriction. There was no education restriction besides having to be in college. And you had to write an essay. And I was a writer, so I wrote the essay. And then in September 2009, I started the internship at 31.
Now, can you take us to that moment when you got that acceptance letter, acceptance email? Can you describe what you read and just the emotions that were running through?
Well, I got the email, but I didn't see it. So I did not know that I got accepted until I got a phone call asking me about my paperwork. And so I didn't turn in the paperwork, the security clearance that you had to turn in to be an intern, that was attached to the email that I actually never saw. And so that's how I found out that I became an in that I got the internship, was actually through this phone call. So once the phone call came, I dug in that black hole of Gmail, finding it in the archive, found the email, and then read it, the acceptance. And I think my heart just dropped. I mean, I couldn't believe, that they wanted me as an intern. I couldn't believe that I, had beat out probably hundreds of thousands of candidates who wanted to work with this president in the first year. And I kept thinking, there's going to be something that's going to stop this. And, but I said, I'm just going to keep, filling out the paperwork and going forward. So it was absolutely unbelievable. It was, a magical time. I think the same feeling I felt when President Obama got elected. And, it just was trying to figure out everything from there to make sure that I had everything turned in for the internship.
Now, receiving that phone call, was that a what you talking about, Willis, type moment?
It was 100% that. I mean, it was more like, who me? Like, who, like, you had the right Deisha Dyer? Like, is there another name? Like, and I also was very surprised that I missed, that I wouldn't get the that I didn't see the email. But I think I deleted it, and thinking it was a spam email. That's what happened. And it was definitely a what you talk about. It was definitely a, can you resend the paperwork? It was definitely, oh my goodness. And thankfully I had somebody on the phone who was like, let me call this intern, versus saying they just didn't get back to us, let us choose someone else. So it could have been completely different had I got a different person on the phone who like looked through that the applications and said, oh, we're missing her paperwork.
Oh yeah. So now let's to talk about your tenure there briefly. Now, you set up some significant things, state dinners. You coordinated with something with Beyonce and Bruce Springsteen. Can you tell us about this social secretary position? Because this is honestly the first time that I heard about it. What is it? What do you do? And what was some of your favorite aspects of the job?
Definitely. So the social secretary is a senior position that sits in the first lady's office. And that role is to execute all of the events, public and private, that happen for the first family or for the nation or for anything inside of the actual mansion. So inside the actual White House. And so I led that charge, and I worked with countless folks besides the people that worked in my office. It was like working with the chefs and the butlers and the florists, the calligraphers, to make sure that we put events together. We would do everything from, as you mentioned, state dinners to concerts, but also we would do things like sports championships, and we would do message events around, critical issues around gun violence or education, and we honor teachers. So everything from the beginning to the end of an event, I was in charge of putting together, making sure that it all came together. There was a run of show by every minute of how things would go, from putting out chairs to serving food to when the president or first lady took the stage. I would, work with the other departments on making sure their speech was laid properly on the podium, communicating with them all the details so they could ask any questions about, how is this set up? Where do I walk? Who's all in the room? And then working with them along the way, the president and first lady, on the actual details to make sure it represents them, right? Make sure it represents the house, make sure it represents what they want to do. Mrs. Obama was very big on opening the house and making it the people's house. And so I just basically took the direction from her and expanded with all the events. And so that's what the social secretary does.
Oh wow. So then you got to sit down and chat and strategize with Michelle Obama then. How was that?
Yes, it was nerve-wracking. I mean, anybody's nervous, of course. She's Michelle Obama. But I think that I just, she always put me at ease. And I think that I just led with my community background and a desire to want to execute, the vision that she was putting forth. And so, I just think I was trying to live up to the confidence that she had in me to do the job, and just, relied on my other coworkers and my team to really fill in the gaps of things I didn't know or things where I was, slipping up. But it was, of course, intimidating. But I got through it.
Now you wrote this book, Undiplomatic, and we're going to get more into it on the other side of the break. But I did want to first talk about this dealing with imposter syndrome, because we all deal with imposter syndrome, especially those who are BIPOC. So with yourself, how did you cope with this imposter syndrome while interfacing with the first lady?
I didn't. I didn't cope too well. That's part of the reason why I wrote the book. I think that I coped by, putting a lot of onus on myself of, you didn't finish college. You're not smart enough. Like, you're only here because, they thought that you were good at what you did, but can you actually live up to this new responsibility? And so I think that it was very hard for me, which is, again, why I wrote the book. But also on the other side of that is I worked really hard at making sure that my work product and the things that I put out were so excellent that there wasn't really a room to say, like, she isn't qualified. Not everything wasn't perfect, but I think that I made it so my work was so on point. But later down the line, as the book goes through the evolution of me with this imposter syndrome, you see that I started to divest from it. I started to divorce it in a way to say, no, I am qualified. Like, whose standards am I trying to live up to? Like, why am I putting the onus on myself of things that happened in the past that make me feel not wanted or not deserved? And so I turned that around, with a bunch of therapy and other things. But I think that the first lady and president having confidence in me really helped, because I was thinking, these are two really powerful people and they're saying that you could do it. So who are you to tell yourself that you can't? Right. And so I learned, the evolution through the evolution of, myself, how to deal with it. But in the beginning, it was very hard. And I can say that, it manifested its way itself in many ways.
In your bio, you described yourself as a round the way girl. First thing, I'm a hip hop head, so that just, activated, I need a round the way,
Exactly.
So can you tell us how do you infuse that into your leadership and authenticity?
Definitely. And I love that you're a hip hop head, because that is the whole point, right, of saying that. But for me, I lead with the culture. That is what I grew up in. That is who I am. So I don't know how to be anything else. I don't have this huge pedigree of, education behind me or strong family structure or some of the other things that people have to lean on. For me, I leaned on the culture, right? And so I always make sure that I bring the community with me wherever I go, whether that's at the White House when, we think of an idea around education and I say, well, why don't we bring in a DJ or a break dancer? Or, you know, whether I'm writing my essay like I did for the White House internship, and I was like, this is how I feel hip hop can really help with education in urban communities. For me, not only that, but I make sure I bring talent from the community. I make sure that I'm being a voice in the room, saying, you know, we're talking about, you know, economic issues. Let's talk about poverty in this, you know, in this realm. Let's talk about this. And so I lead really with the culture and with the community at all times. That means I'm also in touch with the community and culture at all times. So even at the White House, I would go to, you know, ciphers, and I would go to different things that were in Washington, D.C., poetry readings, breakdancing competitions. I would go to like different and see different Black churches and choirs to see if they come sing at the White House. Like, I was always in touch with the community and the culture. That is how I lead. That's how I want to see want the community to see me as a leader. And so that is how I remain authentic, and it hasn't changed. I mean, you know, I quote hip hop a lot in the book. I quote how I listen to it on the way going to work. I still wear my hoop earrings, my door knockers with my name on them. I have my nose ring still. So it's not a lot that has changed, but that's because that is the only person I knew how to be. And that's part of the book's, you know, that's part of the book's mystique and part of the book's love is like, I walked in who I was, you know, and I still remained who I was, even though there were challenges of being like, I look a little different, I feel a little bit different. None of those affected my work or my success at all. It affected me internally, but then again, I fixed that, right? But that's how I lead really with authenticity.
And what are some main components, some key things that you want your readers to glean from Undiplomatic?
Number one, I want readers to take away the mystique that like or the image that politics or any kind of esteem sector that seems closed off and elite is not for them. I want to kind of take away this whole I don't fit in, I don't belong there, I don't have the skills, the assets, the education. None of that is true. You just have to apply and try. That's it, right? I think that too often we are kind of looking at things and we say we're not qualified or we don't look like the next person, but perhaps they're not looking for a copycat. They're looking for somebody else who's a little bit different. That doesn't make everybody else bad. It just means that you're coming with a di different set of unique skills. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is that imposter syndrome is really a sham, really. It's a whole thing that's made up to make you feel at fault for things that are out of your control. You cannot control that, you know, you don't have the same education. That's fine. That doesn't mean that you're not qualified, right? Like, or control some of the other oppressive systems that are set up to keep us feeling like we don't deserve things, right? You know, that's the number one thing I want to take is like, I want people to take the weight off of themselves about imposter syndrome and feeling so heavy about it. So then they can walk in their confidence. They can know they could do things. They can walk with their head tall. And I want people to know that, like, this is a testimony. Like, I took the test so nobody else had to. And this is my testimony that I'm sharing. I'm hoping that it's entertaining and inspiring and hilarious for people. But also, I want people to see themselves in the story, which is why it's an evolution of where I started versus where I ended versus writing the book from just a healed and ended place around imposter syndrome.
So where are you at now in your imposter syndrome journey?
You know, that's a great question. And what I'll say is, I don't ever say I'm over it. I would say that I've navigated it and put it off to the side. It's no longer a main dish on my plate. It comes up when I do things like write a book because I've never written a book before, right? We act like when we go into new spaces that we're supposed to know what we're doing. We're not. Like, we don't know. I don't know how to do this. And so with every new challenge that I give myself, like writing a book or doing all these press interviews, I do feel a little nervous because, you know, that's just, I've never done it before. But now I know it's not the imposter syndrome. It's not that I'm not qualified. It's just new to me. So I think that that's how I approach things now is that it's a learning, it's a curiosity. It's not a bad thing that somebody else has more education or somebody else has more pedigree, or somebody else has more connections. That's not a bad thing. What's a bad thing is if I don't dig deep into who I am and use what I have, right? To then apply to whatever I'm trying to do. So that's where I am on the journey now. I'm on the journey of this is a scam. Like, this is, you set me up. Like, universe, you set me up to feel like things were my fault and my responsibility. And I had to go get more education. I had to do all these things to keep up with people or to keep up with opportunities. But yet, then you showed me I had this whole path, this amazing path that showed me, no, I didn't. Right. And so that is where I am now with it.
So how did you navigate that space writing a book about imposter syndrome while battling imposter syndrome? It's quite the conundrum.
I mean, you don't even know. It sure was. It was quite the conundrum because it was hilarious because I kept telling my husband, and he'd be like, "Disha, you're writing a book about this." I'm like, "I know, but I don't know if I'm qualified." He was like, "Who else is qualified? You are qualified." I'm like, "You know, you're right. I did a whole course at Harvard Kennedy School and Institute of Politics around imposter to impact." And I remember being in the room and being like, "I'm at Harvard. Like, what do these kids need to know from me? I need to be sitting in their classes." But they had a lot to learn, you know what I mean? And I think that for me, when I was writing the book, I had to forgive myself for times that I was stuck in the matrix of imposter syndrome. And it's hard when you write about your past life because you're thinking to yourself, well, I would have never made this decision now, but you have to be like, I don't have the knowledge and the evolution and the healing and the therapy that I have now. I didn't have it then. So I think that writing about it was a whole practice of forgiveness, is a practice of compassion, is a practice of grace. And it also was a practice of just like, I never want to be in that space again. And so I need to make sure that I write this book authentically. So when I need to read it back, so I can remember, if I ever slip, that it is going to be a resource for me and for others. But it definitely was a conundrum. It definitely was a like, oh, is that what I said? And I had to stay true to how I felt then because I didn't want to mislead readers like, oh yeah, I thought I wasn't qualified, but I went for it and felt great. Like that really wasn't how it happened. And so I had to be honest that even with these promotions and accolades and all these things, I still was like treading water, until I wasn't. So yeah.
Disha, real quick, because we are at the end of our show, where can folks purchase the book at?
They can purchase a book anywhere that they get books, any kind of major retailer, independent store. I make sure your libraries carry, you can ask, but also all that's online. But if you need like a little cheat sheet, just DishaDyer.com. And it has all the places listed where you could buy the book. But wherever you can buy it, especially from our indie friends, would be really great.
All right. Well, Disha, I want to thank you for coming on the Spark today and giving us the game, as I like to say. Thank you for coming on the
Thank you
Spark.
For having me.
Yes, my pleasure. Have a good one.